Because you know, so what I'm going to talk about fermionic path integrals and what is called, in fact, how to it's something which is, so I will explain formalism, which is in mainly, in fact, was introduced by the Russian mathematical physicist Berezin, which is very important, that it's called Berezin calculus. Okay? So, well, as you know, fermions are a very important part of the universe. Half of the fields are made out of fermions. And one of the properties of fermions, of spin one-half fields, is that they must obey a statistic which is completely different from fermions, because in fact, once you quantize fermions, you realize that the fermionic field operator must anti-commute instead of commuting. So when you are dealing with bosons, you have a field operator 5x. And you know that at equal time, for instance, at equal time, those field operators phi of x, phi of y, obey some anti-commuting, some commutation relation. They commute at equal time if they are at a different position, and there is something which is a delta function when they are at equal position. Now, for fermions, you have seen by studying the quantization of the second quantization of the Dirac equation, and so the construction of a second quantized theory of a Dirac field, you have seen that, in fact, the fermions is described by a Fermi field, which has four components. Therefore, it can be written like that. So A are the Dirac indices. And at equal, so it has a complex conjugate. And at equal time, those fermionic operators do not obey commutation relation, but they must obey an anti-commutation relation. Therefore, so it's a commutation relation, and it's an anti-commutation relation. Okay, so as far as the canonical formalism is concerned, it's a mathematical, it's a technical problem, if you want, in the sense that it's one knows how to build out matrices which anti-commute instead of matrices which commute. Okay, and the Dirac matrices are one example of matrices which are defined through anti-commutating relation instead of commutating relation. Now, the question is, at the level of functional integral formulation, can we make something like, is it possible to build a functional integral over the fermionic fields? I don't explain what it is at the moment. Is it possible to build a functional integral over a Fermi field with some action, such that when you compute the expectation value of products of Fermi fields, you get the expectation value of, for instance, of the time order products of Fermi operators. So those are operators which are defined, for instance, perfectly well defined through canonical quantization, and my question is, can I formulate this as an average value over the path integral formulation of some objects? And of course, since those objects do not commute but anti-commute, okay, such an integration, if it exists, cannot be done on ordinary numbers. It's psi cannot be ordinary commuting random variables. if such a thing exists, it must be something quite different. Okay? And in fact, that's what the Bayesian calculus will do. So in order to discuss what is Bayesian calculus, though, let us first remind some very, very simple basic facts about integrating functions over the set of complex numbers. Okay, so I consider Cn, and so Cn is a copy, so a vector of Cn is made out by a vector which is a combination of variables Zi, I equal 1 to n. Okay, and if I have a function, let me consider now the algebra of functions from Cn to C. So the complex function over the vector space, the n-dimensional complex vector space. Okay. So so a function, so let me call this algebra A, okay, because it's an algebra. It's a commutative algebra. You can multiply the function. It's a commutative algebra. Very simple algebra. And what is an element of this algebra? An element of its algebra, it's a function g, okay? And this function, or let us call it f if you want, it's a function, so let us call it f. And a function can be written simply as a function of z and z bar. So instead of writing that z I is x I plus I times y I, the real and the imaginary part, we can say that we consider formally as variables z and its complex conjugate z bar. Okay, so z bar is x I minus I y I. Okay, and what does this mean is that simply instead of, for instance, if this function has a Taylor expansion around the origin, it means that this function, instead of expanding it in powers of x and y, I reorganize everything so that I can expand it in powers of zi and I, z bar g and g, with some coefficients f and m, where n means, you see, basically, n means simply the collection of and m means a vector with a collection of integer indices mg. Okay. Okay. So this is just the Taylor expansion of a function from Cn to C expanded in terms of z and z bar. Okay. And this function has, for instance, there is a complex conjugation, of course. So there is a complex conjugation concept, complex conjugation. Okay, because to a function f, you can associate its complex conjugate that will denote f star. But what is f star of z and z bar? It is just, with our notation, sum of n and m of g bar and m, z bar n, z m. Okay. Z bar is just a way to, of course, I have a product here, products, I'm sorry, here I have here I take the products over all products over all I and G. Okay, so this is in fact a compact notation for stating that this is sum over N I M G G bar N M products from I equal 1 to n of z bar n I z m g c I g. Okay, so this is just a function which is a complex conjugate of this function acting on the complex number. And of course, you have an operation of derivation on this on functions. You can, yes. Why is it an if? Because on my lecture, on my unwritten notes, I decided to call it G, and I changed my mind, which was a bad idea after all. Okay. Thank you. Okay, so there is a derivation, and the derivation operation is, of course, that d over dz I of zg to some power n is delta ig n zg zi n minus 1. D over dz I of some z bar mg is always 0. And you have also a derivation over z bar. Okay? You have an operation of integration also. Integration is just the Cauchy integration around the complex curve. And the integration has the properties, of course, that they have all the properties of derivation of integration. And in particular, if you integrate over some curves, Cauchy curves in the complex plane, dz of d over dz of some function, you know that you will get just 0 if the function, so if you integrate 0 if the curve is closed. Okay? And if the function is analytic. Okay? So, and then I will just... So you have an integration, and finally, what I will use is a normalization for integrating over Cn. So I will write that, and I need, I will write this. I will normalize the integration so that what I will call dz, dz bar, okay, it's a double integration over the complex plane for one of the variables, and this will be simply... the standard measure on the plane, so I integrate over the real part and integrate over the imaginary part, and simply I normalize it. I normalize this integral by dividing by pi, because it will make the calculation much simpler. So it's just a normalization. So this measure is a standard measure on the complex plane divided by pi. Okay? Okay, so, and in fact, with these rules of integration, that's all what we need to define a path integral formulation over fields. So this is just the standard way to integrate and derivative function over the complex numbers. You can do the same thing for function over the real number, but it's more natural to consider the complex number. Okay? So now the question is, can we do the same for numbers which, instead of commuting, will be anti-commuting? And here comes the concept of what is called Grassmann algebra. So, what is a Grassmann algebra? And I will consider a Grassmann algebra over the complex numbers. And it's an algebra, I will call it G, capital, so instead of A for algebra, I will write it G for complex, for Grassmann algebra. And it's basically the algebra of functions. It's something which will be considered as the algebra of functions of anti-commuting numbers. So instead of considering the algebra of functions of commuting variables, which are complex variables z and z bar, I will consider an algebra which is generated by some elements. So I will consider some generator of this algebra, which I just denote theta I and theta bar I. So those are just mathematical objects. Okay, I have n different generators. Okay, and simply, so those are mathematical objects, and there is an addition and a multiplication defined on that. So there is an addition law. there is a multiplication law, and all what you imply is that the anticommutator of any of those objects, is always zero. So you see, you have a set of objects which are called the generators of the algebra. Okay, and the only property is that we all these generators anticommute. So this means that if I have, of course, this implies in particular that for I equal g, theta I squared will be equal to zero, because the anticommutator is always zero. Okay. The same for their the theta bar. Okay. So those are strange numbers whose square is always zero. Okay. And of course, I will have that theta I theta g is equal to minus theta g theta I. Okay. Okay. And that's all what I impose on my way to defining the element of the algebra. So, for instance, this is an element of my algebra, of my set of numbers, which is different from any of those. Yes?
So,
theta, I'll come to that later. Okay? Theta and theta bar are conjugate in a mathematical sense, but they are not complex numbers. So, they are not complex conjugate. But they are conjugate, there is a conjugation in this algebra. I will talk about it in a few minutes, okay? And so now, what is a function of these numbers? In the same way that we have defined a function as simply as a Taylor expansion, a complex function is given by its Taylor expansion as a sum of products of the generator z and z bar times some complex number, I will now define a general element of the algebra G, capital G, as a linear combination of products of these generators. Okay? So a general element of the algebra will be something which is just written as So I will first give the general formula. It will be a product of some complex numbers that I will call G, IG. And then I have a product of thetas. Okay. And of theta bar. Okay? And here I denote, I am summing, in fact, just over all possible series of products of I, theta, and theta bar. Now, because of this anticommutation rules, you know, when you have a product of theta and theta bar, you can always use the anticommutation relation. You can use the anticommutation relation to reorganize the products of theta and theta bar so that the theta are on the left, the theta bar are on the right, and in addition, theta 1 is to the left of theta 2, theta 2 is to the left of theta 3, so in fact you have always these indices I less than I 2, less than I 3, etc., and G 1 is less than G 2, is less than G 3. Okay? And then this coefficient here is just a complex, it's a complex coefficient. Okay, so Okay, so this is the general form of an element of the algebra. And you can view it, in fact, you can view it as an abstract function of the thetas and the theta bar. Okay? Okay, so this is a bit complex, but I will give an example immediately. Let us consider the case where you have only n equal 1. You have a Grassmann algebra which has one generator. So if n equal 1, you have only two generators, theta and theta bar. No need to put an index. They satisfy the relation that theta squared equal theta bar squared equals 0, and theta bar equals minus theta bar theta because of the anti-commutation relation. And therefore, what are the possible terms for a general element of the algebra? First, you may have no theta and no theta bar, so you can write this A, where A is a complex number. Then you can have a theta, and I write it B. Then you can have a theta bar with a complex number, which I call C. And then you may have a product of theta and theta bar. And since I have this anti-commutation relation, I can always write the term with theta and theta bar, with theta times theta bar, and therefore I have a complex number C. Okay. So this is a general form of a general element of three, can't you see? So G is characterized by four complex components, A, B, C, D. Okay? So you see that this algebra is a four-dimensional vector space, so the dimension of this algebra for n equal 1, this Grassmann algebra, is 4. You see? Okay? And so now you have a definition but now this algebra has a non-trivial multiplication rules, because exercise, consider that you have a G1 times G2, compute G1 and G2, and you will see that some of the D's will disappear. Because, for instance, if I have to multiply theta by theta bar by a theta bar, I know that theta bar is equal to 0, so this will give automatically 0. So when you multiply, a lot of coefficients disappear. So it do not behave at all as ordinary functions, because basically all the Taylor expansion is truncated at order 1 in any of its generators. Okay, you see. Okay, so in general, for n larger than 1, you can show easily that the dimension of this algebra is, in fact, what is the dimension? It's simply 2 to the power 2n. So the dimension of this algebra grows very quickly with number of generators. Okay? And now what we need to define all this algebra is a conjugation. Okay? So conjugation. Okay? Where is written this conjugation? Yes, the conjugation is just that I will define a conjugation that I denote by a star, so that the conjugate of the generator theta I is just the generator that I call theta bar I. The conjugate of theta bar I is, of course, theta I. So the conjugation is such that the conjugation of the conjugation is the identity. And but then, okay, the conjugation on ordinary numbers, the conjugation on an ordinary number, if I, A is a complex number, the conjugation of A will be just the ordinary complex conjugate, the complex conjugate. So this conjugation is a generalization of complex conjugacy on the thetas and theta bars, but it acts as ordinary complex conjugation on the coefficient of the algebra. Okay? But then we need an important property. We need to know what is the conjugation of a product of two generators. And then we shall need the fact that this conjugation has the same properties as the Hermitian conjugation on matrices. So those numbers do not commute, but if I have two elements, G1 and G2 of the algebra, which are a complicated linear combination of products of generator, I impose that the conjugate of this is the product of G, conjugate of G2 times the conjugation of G1. So you see, so it's both a generalization of complex conjugation on real number, on C, and of Hermitian conjugation on matrices, on complex matrices. Okay? But those thetas are not matrices, because you cannot realize those anti-commutation relations in any finite dimensional matrix as in terms of matrices. You know, there is a simple mathematical theorem which says that you can never realize this anti-commutation relation in terms of matrices, at least in terms of finite dimensional matrices. Matrices are just squares made out of complex numbers. Okay. So it's a generalization of complex of the conjugation on matrices on some objects which are not matrices. Okay? Okay? And for instance, then you see that for this case, in this simple example, what is the complex conjugation? It will be the complex conjugate of A plus the complex conjugate of B times theta bar plus the complex conjugate of C times theta plus the complex conjugate of D times the complex conjugate of theta bar times the complex conjugate of theta, namely theta, theta bar. Because with this definition, the complex conjugate of theta, theta bar, the conjugate of this is theta bar times star times theta star, and therefore it's theta, theta bar. Okay? Okay, so finally, we need to define a derivation on this algebra and an integration. And we shall take the same property. So basically, the property of derivation is that when you take a derivation with respect to a complex variable, you go down by one power times n. So we shall define an operation which is, for the moment, just a formal, it's an operation on the algebra, okay, so that when I derivate the constant function, I get zero. When I take the derivative of, with respect to theta I of theta I, I get one. And that's all, because there are no, I cannot take a derivative with respect to theta I of theta I squared, because theta I squared is equal to zero. Okay? And also, and then you can, of course, in fact, take a derivative with respect to some other, it will be always zero. You can take, you define the same operation with respect to the conjugate variables theta I, theta G equal delta IG. Okay? And then, simply, what you remain is that you have to remember that the You can check easily that. Yes. Okay. And you can check very easily that those. So the derivation is just a linear operation on the algebra, in the same way that derivation on functions is a linear transformation on functions. You can check, for instance, easily that d over theta I of some function g1 times g2. You can check that the ordinary rules of partial derivation applies. So this will be d over theta I of g1 times g2. Then there will be a g1 times d over d theta I of g2. Except that since everything anticommutes, there is a minus sign here. Okay, I think so. Oh no, it depends on the no. It's it depends on the no, that's not true. It depends on the it depends on the so there may be plus or minus sign depending on the okay, because if I you see, for instance, if I want to compute what is the derivative with respect to theta of this generator of this function. So the derivation with respect to A is 1. Here I have B. Okay. Here I have C times the derivation with respect to theta of theta bar, which is 0. And then I have the derivation of with respect to theta of theta bar. And I know that this is, with my rules, theta bar. You see? But if I want to define what is the derivative with respect to theta bar of G, I will get C. But then I have to compute the derivative with respect to theta bar of theta bar. And there is a theta in between the derivative and the theta bar. So I have to anticommute them in order to get d over d theta bar of theta bar times theta. And with the minus signs, and there is a factor d, of course, so I get c minus d theta. So you see, you have to be careful. Every time that you have a derivation with respect to a variable and some theta, you have to they have to anticommute. So you see. Yes?
So Leibniz that you wrote down.
Yes.
I mean that's an extra assumption, right? I mean.
No, you just have to remember that the d theta, d over d theta I, d over theta anticommutes with any theta and theta bar, but it commutes with ordinary numbers.
That's a new assumption.
Yes, that's one of the assumptions. Okay. So each time that you have a theta in your expression, or a theta bar, it anticommutes with the theta, and it doesn't anticommute with ordinary function. Okay? Okay, and finally, we need to define what is an integration. And what is integration? It is just because I will need to define what is an integration for those variables. And basically, I need that the integration of a derivative, in fact, gives you zero up to boundary terms. So I need the rules of partial integration. But here, remember that everything, if you apply everything twice, you give zero. So in fact, you can show very easily from this expression that d over d theta anticommutes with the same, so you can check very easily that the d over d theta I squared is always equal to zero. Why? Because when you take a derivative with respect to some theta of theta, you get something which do not depend on theta. And remember, in any of the G's, you can never have two thetas, because theta times theta is equal to zero. So if you have thetas in some expression, this theta disappears by the first integration, by the first derivative, and once you have that, if you take a second derivative, the second derivative looks for a theta I in this expression. It doesn't find any, so it gives you zero. So the square of a derivative is always zero in this algebra. And therefore, this means that, in fact, the derivative itself has the property we need for integration. So we shall take, as a definition for what is the integration of a function with respect to theta I, that it is simply the derivative with respect to theta I of this element of the algebra. And it works. So in this Grassmann algebra, you know, integration is equal to derivation. And that's enough. So in particular, we have that d over d theta of 1 is equal to 0, and that d over d theta of theta is equal to 1. So you see, in any case, you know, you see that you, when you integrate over a variable, a function of this variable, you get something which do not depend anymore on this variable, as you expect. Okay? When you integrate a constant function, it gives you 0. And that's all what you need. Okay? And you can check then also that the integration of the integration gives always 0. Okay. Okay. So I have defined an integration, and I have defined a derivation. And with this property, you can check in particular that the integration of a derivative of an element of the algebra is always 0, because the derivative makes one theta disappear, and then you have no theta to integrate over. Okay? Okay, so are there any questions? So you see, it seems a very abstract object. We have defined an algebra of functions of some anti-commuting generators. Okay? Yes? Yes, in fact, there is, in this relation, you mean?
Right.
Yes, there is a difference.
So that's not general, right?
Because no, it's not general. There is a sum of the terms. Yeah. So in fact, it's a bit more complicated. So I shouldn't have written such an expression. It's a bit confusing. You can write like that. Okay. Okay. So now. What you want to do is to do Gaussian integrations over Grassmann functions, over Grassmann variables, these variables. Okay. Remember that there is a very important property with this normalization of the algebra function. If I integrate over dzi dz bar I, so the exponential of a quadratic form which is of the form zi bar a I G C G, okay, where A I G the element of a complex Hermitian matrix. With this normalization, that's why I put the pi here. This is just the determinant of this matrix to the power of minus 1. Okay. Here I have put a pi in the measure, and here there is no one-half function, it's self-explanatory, minus this scalar product, this quadratic form, and this is normalization. This integral is just the determinant of A. So we may ask, can we do the same thing? Can we take A to be a complex Hermitian matrix with A dagger K, okay, N by N, and then I define an element of the algebra which is exponential of minus theta bar I Aij theta. That's an element of the algebra. Let us call it E. It's an element of the algebra. Okay? And how do I define this element of the algebra? I just expand the exponential. I just take the Taylor theorem. Of the exponential. Okay? And for instance, if n equals 1, what is the exponential of minus theta bar a theta? It is just 1 minus theta bar a theta. So a is a complex number, theta bar and theta are some constant variables, and it ends there because the second term in the development of the exponential is just theta bar a theta, theta bar a theta divided by 2, but that's an expression where I have 2 thetas, 2 theta bars, so it is 0. So you see, the Taylor expansion ends up at a finite order. You see? Okay? If I have n equal 2, let us write it for n equal 2. For n equal 2, I have a matrix which I will call A equal A11, A12, A21, and A22. And if I want to compute this element, this exponential of theta bar theta, I will have an exponential of this element A, will be given. First, there will be the 1. Then there will be, of course, sum of elements which will be minus theta I Aij theta bar I Aij theta g with the sum of all the indices. Then you will have terms of order. And then we'll have terms of order 2 because you may have products of two elements, because you can have theta bar 1 theta 1 times theta bar 2 theta 2. So you will have, and if we do the calculation, you have the only possible terms are theta bar 1 theta 1 theta bar 2 theta 2 times A11 times A22, and then you have theta bar 1 theta 2 theta bar 2, theta 1, A12 times A21. You see? And that's all. Because all the other terms contains two times the same generator of algebra, and therefore this gives 0. You see? And now, let us apply our rules of what is integration. Let me compute what is the integral for n equal 1. Let me compute what is the integral of a theta bar times the integral of theta of this E. Exponential of minus theta bar A theta. Okay? I have to integrate this over theta bar and theta. The integrate over theta bar of 1 gives you 0. The integral over theta of theta bar
of theta equals to A, but I have to amplitude mu, so this will only these terms will determine. So I will, this will be minus A and the integral over theta bar, the integral over theta of theta bar theta. In order to do the integration, I will anticommute those two in order to integrate theta over theta. I get a minus sign. There will be a theta bar. Let us do it carefully. This is plus A integral over theta bar, integral over theta, theta times theta bar. This is 1. So this is A times integral over theta bar of theta bar. This is 1. So this is equal to A. Okay? Now let us do it for the case n equal to 2. This is theta bar 1 d theta 1 d theta bar 2 d theta 2 exponential minus this theta bar I a I g theta g. I do the same calculation. The integration over those two terms gives you 0. Only this term will give a non-zero term. You will get a contribution with A11, A22. So we'll get something which is A11, A22. And then you will get a contribution with A12, A21. Now you have to work out, we have to be careful, because in order to do the integration of thetas, you have to anticommute the theta bar and theta bar in order to do the integration in a successive order. And if you do that, it's a simple exercise. You discover that here there is at the end a plus sign, but here there is a minus sign. You see? So what is this object for a matrix like them? This is just the determinant of the matrix A. Yes?
I don't understand why you still have I and j in the last expression.
Pardon?
You have I and j in that.
You have A.
The last expression you wrote.
This one?
Yeah. So why do you have
I can write this simply. I can write this as A11 plus theta bar 1 A12 theta 2 plus etc. So I write this here just like using the Einstein notation for summing over complex over repeated unity, and here I wrote it explicitly. See, it was that. See. So if you prefer, write it that way. Here you have four terms, and here you have only two terms, all the other one is the two. Okay? But this term is unimportant if you integrate over it. So what is important is this result. So you see, so the integration of the Grassmann variables of the exponentials gives you the determinant of the matrix instead of giving you the inverse of the determinant of the matrix if there were complex ordinary variables. Yes?
And there's nothing special about these matrices.
It is?
There's nothing special at all about these matrices? That was just...
No, I just assumed that it was... I assumed that it was an Hermitian matrix. But in fact, nowhere in the calculation you need the expression to the matrix to be Hermitian. So in fact, it's a general. I assume that it was Hermitian, so that this is this element is such that E equals G star.
Okay, so if this element is to be real, if you want, in the sense of Grassmann algebra, this has to be an Hermitian. But in fact, it's a general result for any matrix A. Because in Grassmann, when you integrate over Grassmann algebra, you never have to care about whether this integral is convergent at infinity. So you never have to care whether the matrix is Hermitian and positive definite. So this is, of course, a result which is valid if the A, I'm sorry, I will write this, A is dagger, and if the matrix A is positive definite, namely all its eigenvalues have to be positive. Here I am doing just algebra, So I don't have to care about whether those integrals are convergent or not. There is no concept of convergence. Okay, I'm just manipulating symbols, you know. Anti-commuting theta, theta bar, and sometimes, you know, killing some terms. Okay, so it's just plain algebra. Yes?
Yeah. In that integral you wrote, integral of A, integral of theta,
yes.
Yes. Supposed to be zero now.
The integral of that?
The theta, theta bar.
Yes.
Is it not zero?
It is now?
Is it not zero?
What?
The last expression, the first expression you wrote.
I know, bar missing on the...
You mean, which expression?
From that?
Over
there.
This one?
Up. Yeah.
This is non-zero, I am sorry, I'm very, very sorry. First, I integrate over theta, this gives you one, it remains integral over the theta bar of theta bar, which gives you A. I'm sorry, it was a misprint, a choke print, a mischoke. Yeah, okay? So, exercise, you know, commute and anti-commute all the thetas and the theta bar, and check that you get a plus sign here, a minus sign, therefore this is the determinant. Now, here comes a miracle. For n, for any n, then the integration becomes more complicated, but you work a little bit more, and you discover that this is a general formula, and I will write it in a very compact way with d theta bar d theta of exponential of minus theta times a times theta bar a, where now I consider that theta is a vector of theta highs. Theta bar is a vector made out of the theta bar high. This is a quadratic form in the Grassmann algebra defined as theta a times theta bar is just, I'm sorry, theta bar is just with Einstein notation theta bar I, a I g. Theta G, summing over all dummy indices. This is always equal to the determinant of the matrix A, where now A is a n by n matrix. Okay? Okay, so first miracle, you always compute determinant when you are computing Grassmann integrals of Gaussian integrals in Grassmann algebra gives you determinants instead of inverse of determinant. Okay, Gaussian integrals give you determinants. Okay. So that's the first nice aspect about Grassmann algebra. Now, using that, this is a number. This is a complex number. All the thetas and the theta bars disappear. So now you can define with the same rules what is the expectation value of, for instance, of a product. So now I want to define expectation values of theta and theta bars. Okay? Once you have a Gaussian measure, a Gaussian random variables, you can compute expectation value of number. And let us do it the same thing. I can compute now what is the expectation value of the products of a theta high and the theta bar G using such a weight. Okay, and so of course this will be defined exactly as in the case of ordinary Gaussian variables. This will be defined as the ratio of the integral over all the Grassmann generator of now an element of the algebra, which will not be just the exponential of minus theta bar dot a dot theta, these things that I have been computing before, but then I had some theta I and some theta bar g. So it's another element algebra, and I am allowed to integrate over all the theta. And at the end, I will get a complex number for this integral. It's more complicated to compute, but I will get a complex number. And since I'm doing an expectation value, I will divide by one complex number, which is the results of this integral. You see? And I have no time to do the calculation, but you can check the calculation on those simple examples. What do you find? You find the same results than for Gaussian integrals. You find the matrix element IG of the inverse of the matrix A. You see? So it looks like Vic theorem for two variables. Okay? So I have for this object the same result than for Gaussian variables. Okay? It's just the inverse of the quadratic form. But now you have to remember that the theta highs anti-commutes. And therefore, if I compute now with the same rules theta bar I theta g, since the thetas and the theta bar anti-commute, I will not find a minus 1 of ig. I will get minus a minus 1 of ig. You see? In fact, I will get the complex conjugate of that because so it's okay if the matrix is anti-commuting. So you see that already now the expectation value of those anti-commuting numbers anti-commutes. You see? And now here comes the best of the thing. Now let me compute the expectation value of the products of two Grassmann and variables like that. I do the calculation. What do I find? I found that this is this matrix element IG A minus 1 KL. Okay, I find the matrix element of IL, the matrix element of KG, but with a minus sign because of the anti-commutating relation. So I get what is this? This is simply the expectation value of theta I theta bar G times theta K theta bar L minus the anti-commutation, the expectation of value of theta I theta bar L times the expectation value of theta k theta bar g. Okay? So I get a Vic theorem because this means that when I am computing the expectation value of a product of anti-commuting variables, I have to take all the possible pairings, and one pairing is this one, which gives me these terms, and one pairing is this one, which give me these terms. So the Vic theorem is that I have to find pairs of thetas and theta bars, but I have to sum over pairing of thetas and theta bars, but taking into account the anti-commutation rule. Because once I have done this pairing, here I don't have to do something, but for this one, if I want to apply this kind of Vic theorem, fermionic Vic theorem, I have to move this theta bar to the right of theta, so it gives a minus sign, a plus sign, and then I have to move this theta bar to the right of theta in order to compute this object. This gives a minus sign. So I have to take into account the anti-commutation rules, which gives me signs plus or minus 1, plus 1 or minus 1, which is in fact the signature of the permutation. See, in order to go from this theta bar, etc., up to when I have the pairing, theta bar for the first pairing, theta bar for the second pairing, and in this way, theta bar for the third pairing, etc. So you see that fermionic Gaussian integrals gives you, for expectation value of products of those strange variables, a fixed theorem with the fermionic anti-commutation rule. Okay? And now I have everything I need to build a Feynman path integral formulation for fermions. Okay? Because now let us come back to the physics. So up to now, during this hour, I've just been doing math. Now, let us come back to the quantization of the Dirac field. And remember, Dirac field is given by, at the level of the first quantized theory, you know, you have a field psi of x, which is given by the psi A. A equal 1, 2, 4. I am in four dimensions. I am in Minkowski space-time. So I adopt the signature minus, plus, plus, plus. So A are the Dirac indices. I have two conjugate fields, psi and psi dagger, which is psi bar of A equal 1, 4. A are the Dirac indices. Okay? And I know that the Dirac equation derives from an action principle. Okay? So I can have an action for this, which is simply the integral of a d4x of psi bar of x I d slash minus m psi of x, where, of course, d slash is the sum of a gamma mu d mu, and the gamma mu are the standard Dirac. It's a Dirac matrices with indices A, B. Those are the Dirac matrices. Okay? Which obeys, so I will take the, so here I take the metric, which is my chosen metric, but I will choose for the gamma the definition of for which has, for instance, in the Peskin's book, so the gamma are 2 4 by 4 Dirac matrices, but gamma squared equal 1. The gamma I squared equal minus 1 for I equal 1 to 3. And those Dirac matrices anti-commute. So gamma mu, in fact, with my notation, gamma mu, gamma nu equal to minus 2 h mu nu with my choice of h mu nu. Okay? And with this, if you consider that psi is just the wave function of a Dirac, of a fermions in the first quantized quantity, you know, the component of psi A are just complex numbers. You see? So they're complex functions. In the first quantized theory, Dirac fermion, psi A of x and psi bar A of x are just complex functions. Okay? But the relation between psi and psi bar is, if I am right, psi bar is in fact the complex conjugate of psi r of x. It's a complex conjugate, so let us call it this star. It's a complex conjugate of this times the matrix Zermanot. So there is a relation. This function psi bar is not the complex conjugate of this function. It's a complex conjugate times gamma naught. Okay? And it comes because in this way the action is Lorentz invariant. This is in order to write it. And in fact, when you take the extremum of this action, so we get delta S over delta psi bar of x, you get the Dirac equation. For psi of x. So, in fact, this action describes a classical quantum field theory, a classical field theory whose solution are the wave function of the first quantized Dirac equation. Okay? And the question is, can we second quantize this classical field theory by functional integral. And we cannot do that by just integrating over the psi being considering as complex function, because we won't get the correct anticommutation relation for the operator. But now we have the answer, because Mr. Berezin tells us the answer. It is simply that I have to consider now a very big Grassmann algebra. Okay. Which is generated by, so the element of this Grassmann, the generators of this Grassmann algebra are anti-commuting fields instead of vectors. So instead of having a Grassmann algebra which is, you see, generated by two vectors with anti-commuting variables, I replace this vectors by fields, namely a vector which I will call psi, which could be given by the psi of x with x belonging to Minkowski space. Okay? But those are anti-commuting, so each psi of x is an anti-commuting Grassmann variable. So it's a generator of the algebra. And similarly, psi bar will be another anti-commuting variables, x. So for to each point of space-time, we associate an anti-commuting Grassmann variables, its conjugate, and of course, psi bar is the conjugate of psi. So psi bar is a conjugate of psi in the sense that I have defined before. And then I can define now an action S, which would be simply the integral over d4x of psi bar of x I d slash minus m psi of x. So exactly the same action that the classical action for the Dirac equation, but now this action is a non-commutative number, so it's an element of this big algebra. Okay? Because the psi and the psi bar anti-commute now. You see? I have that psi of x psi of y. The anti-commutator is always zero, etc., and the same for the psi and the psi bar. So the psi and the psi bar anti-commutes even at equal time. You know, those are anti-commutating variables. They do not correspond yet to quantum fields. They are just anti-commutating variables, anti-commutating elements in a very, very big Grassmann algebra generated by those numbers. Okay, those anti-commuting numbers. And then I can define a functional integral, simply integral over these variables, simply by what I have been I wrote before. I define simply an integral which is a product formally on each point of space-time of d psi bar of x d psi of x exponential of I over h bar this action. Okay? And if I am doing that, if I am computing that, I am getting a complex number. Because I have a very complicated element of the algebra, but I am integrating over all the generators of the algebra, so at the end, I should get a complex number. What should be this complex number? It should be simply the up to a constant, the normalization, the determinant of the quadratic form, so it could be the determinant of the Dirac operator acting on functions minus m. You see? And finally, from the rules what we got before, we know how to compute what is with this action functional and this functional integral principle, we know how to compute what is the expectation value of two Grassmannian variables at two different points. Because we know that this is just the matrix element of the operator h bar I over I d slash minus m between the points x and y. Okay? And if you do just a bit of calculation, you recover that this is simply in Fourier transform. It is a Fourier transform in over Minkowski space of, and then I just have to check because I'm not completely sure of the results. You will get I over minus well, I'm not completely sure. So of course you have to now remember that those psi carries. I'm sorry. Those psi carries, of course. In addition, Dirac indices R equal 1 to 4. Those are the Dirac indices. So this is a matrix element AB. Okay? So it's, if I am integrating this and this, times exponential of IK times X minus Y. You see? Pardon?
Yeah.
This is? Yes, psi bar A. Okay. And it's just an application of all the rules that have been given for Grassmann integration. So you don't have to work much about thinking what you are doing. Here there is an I epsilon because in fact you have to be a little bit careful. You can do the same thing in Euclidean space. And then go back to Minkowski by Vic rotation. Okay, and you, in fact, you get a formula which is precisely the expectation value in the vacuum of the theory, of the V-attack theory, of the time order product of the fermionic operator in canonical quantization of the Grassmann of the Dirac field. So these are the, so this is the Feynman propagator. For a Dirac fermion. And since the theta and the thetas, you are computing expectation value within a Grassmann integrals of anti-commutating variables. Therefore, those objects anti-commute, and you get, since those objects anti-commute, you get the correct anti-commutation relation for the psi and psi bar. For instance, you get that the t product of psi a of x psi bar b of y is equal as an operator to psi a of x psi bar b of y if x is in the future of y. But since those psi anti-commute, you get that this is psi by of b of y psi a of x with a minus sign if y is in the future of x. And you get that, well, so you get the correct commutation relation, anti-commutation relation for this object. And of course, you get also that if x and y are causally separated, then the order is not important. But you get that those two operators, psi a of x, psi b of y, is equal to minus psi b of y, psi a of x, if they are causally separated. So the rules of Feynman of functional integration over Grassmannian fields gives you immediately, without any pain, all the correct anti-commutation relation for fermionic, for the operator associated to a fermionic field. You see? Okay. And that's it. You have defined this seemingly abstract way of computing functional integration, a path integral formulation, not on path in a physical space, but in this very strange algebra of function of anti-commuting numbers. And at the end, you get a very quick way to compute expectation values of operators in an theory involving fermions. Because, of course, you also finally, this is the result for string, but then you have, of course, you recover the Vic theorem for computing vacuum expectation value of products of more than two fermionic operators. Okay. And that's it. So now we know how to quantize by path integral formulation quantum fields involving fermions. Thank you. Okay, well, any question? Well, I'm sure there are questions. Yes?
So, on the left-hand side, on the top of the board, there is no need to introduce a time ordering.
No, because it's exactly as the same way as what was happening for bosonic field. Here, I am computing an expectation value in some big integral of products of some objects. And the formalism is consistent, so that in addition, if you work, I have been, of course, a bit sketchy here, because I gave you the receipt, I said, okay, now that I have those rules, here is the rule that I must apply. But if I apply those rules, I check that there is no need to introduce any time ordering here, because it will give you the time ordering at the end. If you want to think a little bit about that, in fact, you have, of course, to think more about how to go to the classical theory to these rules. So at the moment, this is a recipe, a cooking recipe, and I just told you that this recipe works. You have to work a little bit more to show that this is the right recipe.
The last one where X and Y are space-like separated?
Yes.
Those are both size, there's no side bar in the...
No, there is a side bar. Right. Yes. In that case, yeah. The product of psi is zero. You know what? You can compute also psi and psi.
Right.
Yes?
In there, last expression on the left board, should there be a factor of h bar somewhere?
Anna?
Last expression on the left board, there should be a h.
Oh, yes, there is an h bar. Yeah. What is h bar here? And here?
Yeah, in the determinant.
Oh, yes, so this is the normalization of the. This is the normalization of the determinant. So it's a constant in the front of that. Yes?
This weak rotation, useful?
Pardon?
This weak rotation, useful for Fermions?
Yes, because in fact, you may have in several individual problems to consider as Euclidean Fermion in Euclidean space. For instance, people who are studying gauge theories by the way of computer simulation.
For each point in space.
They are
computing expectation value of operators using the path integral formulation in a discretized space-time, but you can do that only, or very easy, you can do that easily in an Euclidean space-time, because then you are sampling with an exponential of something the action. So in lattice computer simulation of lattice gauge theory, if you want to take into account fermions, you have to compute quantities associated to fermionic fields in Euclidean space-time, too. So for the same reason that it's for some problem useful to consider the quantum field theory in an Euclidean space-time, if the theory contains fermions, you of course obviously have to consider those fermions in an Euclidean space-time. Another example, I will be very, very sketchy, is that some quantum field theory are equivalent to some problem of statistical physics. And for instance, one very notable example is the two-dimensional Ising model. You can formulate the partition function of the two-dimensional Ising model as the partition function of a quantum field theory. But this quantum field theory lives in Euclidean space-time because the two-dimensional Ising model, there is one dimensional space and another dimensional space, and there is no time. This, at the critical point for the Ising model, this quantum field theory turns out to be precisely of a theory of two-dimensional, massless, free fermions, Dirac fermions. That's something, very, very beautiful results, which goes back to the solution of the Ising model by Onsager in 49, I think. Therefore, this is an example where you have a non-trivial physical problem, which is formulated in terms of fermions, quantum Dirac fermions, in a two-dimensional Euclidean space-time. So it's useful. Yes?
An example of what you talked about in the first lecture.
Yes, so that's an example of, you mean of the
relation between path integral and statistical mechanics?
Yes.
It's an example of, remember I showed at the beginning of the first, said that you have a free particle is equivalent to a chain of springs, which is a model of statistical mechanics. So if you consider a two-dimensional free field, it's equivalent to the problem of the statistical mechanical problem of a lattice of springs. Okay, so two-dimensional bosons in Euclidean space-time, two-dimensional quantum bosons in Euclidean space-time are equivalent to a very simple statistical mechanical problem, which is the mechanics of a two-dimensional lattice of coupled springs. So you have phonons propagating sound waves, etc. Okay, you can describe that in terms of a quantum problem of two-dimensional bosons. And then what I was saying is that another problem which is highly non-trivial, which is a two-dimensional Ising model, is equivalent to a quantum problem, which is a two-dimensional Euclidean fermions, Dirac fermions. Another question? Okay.
Yeah, you have a sort of
exactly the same way for
Well, barely, but I